This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Late last month, though, you might have noticed that eToro, the digital stockbroker, delaying its $10.4 billion SPAC listing. We'll get into that. For an update on the business here at Milken, let's bring in Yoni Assia. Did I say it right? Co-founder and CEO of eToro. The company pointing out it is the world's largest trading network right here at Milken, normally based in Israel, but doing a little bit of traveling now that the world is opening up. How are you?
Very good, very good. Excited to be in LA for first in 25 years.
Really?
Yeah. I used to spend here a lot as a kid.
Wow.
But I haven't been here for a while.
A lot of things have changed. A little bit?
Well, I'm just here at the hotel all the time, so I don't know.
Same with me.
So let's talk about eToro and what's been going on. We're going to get into your listing. But in the meantime, talk about the business and the growth. What are you seeing?
Well, we've seen explosive growth over the past 18 months, really starting, as we talked about before, with the beginning of the pandemic, just at the inflection point and the rise of retail investors with a whole new generation across the world, millennials realizing that they want to invest in the markets, whether it's stock markets, whether it's U.S. stock markets, or whether it's crypto markets, just increased interest all around the world. We founded the company in 2007 with a vision of opening the global markets for everyone to trade and invest in a simple and transparent way. And up until 2020, beginning of 2020, we had about 12 million registered users. And since then, we added more than 11 new million registered users by the end of the first half 2021. So basically, we doubled the company, more than doubled the company.
So 23 million? How many?
So 23 million registered users worldwide, grew by 5.6 million registered users the first 6 months this year, after growing about 5 million registered users the entire of last year. We've grown significantly our business, and we've seen the shift from the first crypto rally in 2017. We've seen our business grow rapidly from $60 million commission to $390 million from 2016 to 2018, really driven by the crypto rally.
Yeah.
And then we saw crypto winter, and in crypto winter, we sort of drove our customers who came to eToro to trade back then, you know, XRP, Ethereum, to diversify into equities through the social network where they can actually see what other people are trading and see each other's performance and copy the most successful investors. And then we saw crypto winter shifted the business into equities and commission-free stock trading worldwide, and
right.
Then started this year with Crypto Rally 2.0, which is just an amazing rally.
Yoni, I hear what you're saying, and I imagine some of our listeners are thinking to themselves, wait a second, this is a similar story as to what propelled Robinhood to the public markets in a relatively short time into such massive growth in the year 2020 and 2021. But we are seeing that Robinhood shares are down more than 40%, partly due to some softness, what the company referred to as seasonality earlier this year. Are you seeing any of that decline in activity, any of that seasonality that we heard from Robinhood?
So sensitive to the fact that we're in the process of transforming from a private company to a public company, I can only share companies' data relevant for the first 6 months, which we published, which were very good. We did update the markets that Q3, and this is something you can look at exchange data. So equities have been softer in Q3. If you look just at exchange data, options data, volumes in equities and volatility.
It was a tough September.
have gone down generally in the markets. And now we're seeing, obviously, crypto rally 2.0, the longest crypto rally in crypto history, in Q4 sort of returning with a roar. So hoping to see Bitcoin reach all-time high, already peaked and touched actually market cap all-time high over the last 48 hours. So very interesting to see what's happening in crypto in Q4.
Yoni, who are you competing against? Is it Robinhood? Is it all of the online trading platforms, even the establishment? Who is it?
So the way we see it, and again, we're very global. And we have our business is Europe, U.S., Asia, Latin America, Middle East. We're regulated across the world. And in every single country, what we see is the discount brokerage 1.0 was very much consolidated by the local banks. So here, you know, Schwab bought TD, Morgan Stanley bought E-Trade. And we see the same in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, in the UK, everywhere. But who we're really competing in against is those super apps, right? Apps like eToro, who are attractive to a new audience, new customers that are beginning their trading activity are looking for new tools, for ways to engage and learn how to trade the markets, how to participate in the markets. And
right.
there's a lot of great companies just expanding the audience and expanding the markets.
Hey, Yoni, you mentioned that you're in the process of transitioning from a private company to a public company. Is it still going to happen in the fourth quarter?
We are currently expecting the de-SPAC process in Q4 and very excited about this transition at a $10.4 billion valuation.
Still with Betsy Cohen's SPAC FinTech acquisition?
Yes, yes.
FTCV?
FTCV.
It's going to happen?
It's going to happen in Q4, currently in progress.
Nothing could derail it?
You know, I come from capital markets. There's always probabilities of something happening somewhere, sometime, but Bitcoin is also here to stay.
One last question, 20 seconds here. Is it a younger demo that definitely is using the platform? Is that who it is, or is it?
It's younger demo versus the incumbents for sure. The median age in eToro is 34 versus 60 plus in some of the incumbents.
Stay in touch. We want to talk with you, especially when you go through your going public in the fourth quarter. Yoni, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yoni Assia, he is co-founder, CEO of eToro, joining us here at the Milken Institute Global Conference. Fascinating, right? In terms of the growth.
Really fascinating. Yoni, you got to come visit us in New York, too.
Yes.
All right.
Done November.
November, he says.
We're going to hold you to it. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stanovic, and this is Bloomberg.
Well, earlier today, we spoke with Bridgewater Associates Sustainability Co-CIO, Karen Carniel-Tambor, at the Milken Global Conference. In this excerpt, Karen told us all about how investors are increasingly more interested in having portfolios aligned with ESG. Check it out.
The revolution that I feel like has occurred is that a few years ago, a very, very small subset of investors really wanted to talk about this issue.
Yeah.
And now, predominant number of investors say, I care about this issue, my stakeholders care about this issue, I want my capital aligned. Now, what does it mean? How do you measure it? How do you actually do it at a whole portfolio level? That's evolving very quickly from very nascent to developing very quickly. And one of the biggest shifts you're seeing is, you know, people went from kind of not caring about it to, let's do it with like a tiny part of my portfolio. I'll have a couple really awesome projects to write about in my annual report.
Right.
To, wait a minute, if this actually matters, it matters at a whole portfolio level. I need to see a top down across all the asset classes, think about my strategic asset allocation.
How do you think about measuring it?
So we're a systematic fund. We do everything systematically. So when I started approaching this issue with my team, we were sort of saying, we have to find a way to systematically measure it. And I think the systemization matters even more here than in other issues because you have so much personal opinions. You don't want to rely on, you know, someone in the morning saying, I think this company's good, I think it's bad. So we basically try to build a process that goes through thousands of securities around the world and assesses their alignment to the United Nations SDGs.
What is the connection that you found between that measure and returns?
I think the most valuable way for investors to think about it is that there's sort of two dimensions or even three dimensions you want to think about investing. There's the part that's just about returns, where all you need to do is look at what's happening in the world right now with the energy crisis, with what's happening mm-hmm. in fiscal policy to say, clearly, if my job as an investor is to imagine what's going to happen in the world relative to what's priced in, I can't ignore these issues. It's obviously causing big changes in assets and so on and so forth and going to drive our broad outlook. There's the risk side, which is, you know, typical risk controls are not well configured to think about what if we have a bad climate outcome or a fast climate transition. But then you have this third dimension, which is just impact, saying, yeah, I could maybe find ways to make money that are unaligned with this, but I actually want my money aligned with this beyond just thinking about returns. I want to be contributing to these issues.
Karen, Tim and I talk all this time that, you know, here we are going through quarterly earnings and, you know, we're looking at margins, top, bottom line, all these different metrics. Like, we get this, right? And investors get this. Shouldn't there be some kind of ESG metric? How do we find a way to let the companies make that transition that might have a financial impact? Does the SEC need to come up with some metrics that says every quarter we want to know revenues, we want to know earnings, but we also want to know that ESG metric, and that's going to matter?
Well, I think ESG is a really broad universe.
It
is. Every environmental or social issue this is going to develop, but let me take the one that's furthest along, which is carbon. Because you have this world where basically every government in the world has said, I want to find a way to transition my economy to have net zero emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a very clear path of, for every company, you can actually say, well, what are they responsible for? What are their emissions? And if you take seriously that governments through time will find a way to transition and put the policies in place, whether it's incentives or taxes or whatnot, companies that don't do it are going to have a problem. And so with carbon, I think we have the clearest path of this is literally what needs to be measured. Mm-hmm. I think most companies know they're going to be forced to report their carbon footprint. They're going to be forced to report it in different ways. There's a couple different templates that have been created out there of what that reporting is like. And it's giving investors a very clear roadmap between kind of government commitments, this is what we want the economy to do,
right,
to specific company reports of whether or not they're aligned with that.
What's the penalty then, ultimately?
Well, just look at the amount of capital all around the world that's shifting. Investors are pretty clearly saying that they want to be aligned with putting their capital towards where we'll be aligned with a net zero transition. How many people have made a commitment saying, I want my portfolio to be net zero?
But they'll give up some performance because of that?
Well, if you're a large institution and you have a multi-decade commitment to being aligned with net zero,
mm-hmm.
that's a binding constraint. You don't really have any choice. You've got to go meet that commitment.
All right, and that was Karen Carniel-Tambor. She is the co-CIO for sustainability over at Bridgewater Associates. We caught up with her here at the Milken Institute Global Conference. Keep in mind, folks, we know this, you know this, we talk about it, sustainable investment. It is growing assets, in fact, up to $35.3 trillion globally last year amid mounting concerns about societal inequities and climate change. We're seeing, Tim, so much money go into this area.
We see a lot of money going into it, but I go back to the question that you and I ask over and over again about metrics and about, you know, what moves Netflix's stock tomorrow. Is it Netflix's comments about ESG? No,
right.
It's Netflix's comments about subscribers in the most recent quarter and how they're thinking about this current quarter.
And I got what she said about, you know, being carbon neutral, right? Or net neutral in terms of what governments are requiring companies to do. But I do feel like that I wonder if the metrics need to be amped up a little bit.
And what do those metrics look like?
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a standardization of them?
Exactly. But it's definitely an investment area. As she said, people are talking about it and dealing with it a lot more than they ever were. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, watching us on YouTube, and this is Bloomberg Radio. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, live at the Milken Institute Global Conference in Beverly Hills here out on the West Coast. We've got a really great guest to wrap up our first day here. His company founded in 2018, and they are leveraging software, a software-first approach, if you will, when it comes to how we manufacture things. We're talking about industrial automation. We're so delighted to have with us Bright Machines CEO and co-founder Amar Hanspal. He's with us here at Milken. Welcome to Bloomberg Business Week.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us about what you're doing. I'm fascinated because increasingly we know so much in our world has been automated. You're taking it to another level.
Yeah, what we do is we build autonomous assembly lines. So you think of autonomous cars, you can imagine them, you know, kind of driving themselves. So we're doing kind of the same idea, but applying it to building products. So, you know, we call ourselves Bright Machines because we're giving eyes and brains to machines and using that intelligence, if you will, to create these what used to be labor-centric assembly lines and replacing them with entirely machine-powered, software-powered ways of assembling products. I mean, if you look at any product, the ones that are surrounding us right now, it's kind of like if you imagine imagine all the piece parts of these products, they're made by machines, but they're assembled by humans.
Right.
And we're changing that so that they're even assembled by humans, assembled by machines. So the entire process is automated.
Amar, what are some examples of processes that you've been able to automate that until you showed up at Bright Machines or created Bright Machines were processes that companies required people for?
I would say assembly in particular. So you think of look at the products surrounding us. So you think of the network infrastructure that's connecting our computers to the internet. You think of the electric vehicles, all the components that go in them. All those pieces, so let's take a piece of network infrastructure. You look at a modern day router. Assembling that router used to be done by hand in a place like China or Mexico. That's the thing that we have replaced using our autonomous assembly line. So robots and other machines are basically putting all the pieces in place and building network boxes, and we're doing that
Amar,
for customers.
I think that's what was kind of surprising, kind of reading in for this, is that I think I had thought so much was already automated.
Right.
Give us your snapshot of what you see.
I mean, the reality is less than 8% of the assembly lines in the world are automated. And you see all, you know, robots have been around for 40 years.
Right.
But the reality has been that to set up these systems takes so much time and costs so much and requires a level of expertise that only, you know, the big automotive or the big aerospace companies that have lots of money and have 5-year product cycles have been able to automate. You look at any kitchen appliance in your house,
right?
That's not automated because it takes too long to configure or cost too much to configure.
So you're saying
that.
My bullet that I use to make my shakes?
It's actually a good example.
Really? It's not automated?
It's you look at that bullet, pieces of the steel and the plastic are made by machines, but they're all assembled by hand. And that's the kind of thing that when you, you know, and you bring it, you bring technology like ours to bear, you can, you know, assemble that using a modern weapon.
If ultimately we reach the point where humans are replaced on automation.
You knew we were going
to go there. You had to go there. Then it creates it's a transformational shift when it comes to the labor market. It's something we talked about earlier with David Hunt at PGEM.
Yeah.
Right? You know, this is the type of thing that can actually prevent inflation from getting out of control.
Exactly.
But when does that happen and what is the massive shift?
So let me give you three parts of the answer. First of all, this kind of high level of automation has happened in other industries. And, you know, banks are a great example. When ATMs came, it didn't result in like unemployment for all the people that, you know, you automated the most repetitive and kind of mind-taxing work. And that's what's happening in manufacturing. If you think about, it's not meant to be dystopian, but when you go into factories today, there are robots everywhere, but the robots are humans. And you'd see humans in factories doing the same operation 100,000 times a day. They'll literally insert screws, you know, four screws into a box and screw. Like, that is mind-numbing work, right? And so that's the kind of thing that systems like ours replaces. But you're right. When we do that, there is somebody that's affected. But what we've seen our customers do is that they look at automation as an augmentation exercise, that they're increasing the ability of a single person to do multiple, you know, more work, or have them do more valuable work, like do better customer service, do better engineering, do better design. And that's what I think will happen. It'll take, definitely you go through a curve where people need to be retrained, but on the other side of it, it's a much better experience for everybody.
But it's safe to say that there are going to be people who are doing that repetitive work today that we won't need those jobs in the future.
Right. And in fact, I would say one of the things that you see today is there are unfilled manufacturing jobs around the world for that very reason. Some people don't want those jobs. So in the United States, there's 400,000 manufacturing jobs that are open, that are unfilled,
right?
Because it's actually hard to find. Either they require a very high level of skill, or the kind of skill they require is so basic that people don't want those
jobs. You're hearing in the background all those people who don't want those jobs. No, they're getting ready for another event here.
Yeah.
No, but it is interesting. So it makes such sense. Like, why wouldn't everybody just automate everything?
Right.
Why aren't people? Is it expensive?
Yeah, it's, I would say up until now, you know, I think it's been daunting to automate, and it's always been from an expense perspective, from a time perspective, and that, you know, when companies like ours shows up and changes the economics of automation, I think people get more ready.
Right.
The other thing that has happened is there has been a perfect storm in the last 2 years between the pandemic, between tariff wars, and then a little bit of security concerns that have really accelerated people's interest in automation.
Hey, Mar, how do you future-proof these assembly lines?
Yeah.
If a customer makes a big purchase,
that's a good point,
and automates it, how do they know 2 years from now it's going to be still good?
So glad you asked that question. And software is the secret sauce, because what we do through software is make our lines programmable. Mm-hmm. So effectively, since our secret sauce is we use software to configure and run these machines, that software can be used to modify the same line to build a different product.
So we can upgrade the software, doesn't impact the hardware, the existing hardware,
If you completely change the product, let's say you are building your bullet and now you're going to build a network router, yes, you need to change the end of arm grippers and some of the feeding systems. But if you're upgrading the bullet or you're doing a second model of that, then you don't need to do that.
So you're going to go public this year?
That is the plan. We announced our transaction, 17th of May, a SPAC merger, and we are in the process of de-SPACing. We filed our S-4 today, and you know, when the SEC gives us the go-ahead, then we shall be a public company.
Come back and talk to us.
Will do.
We would love to continue this conversation. Amar, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Amar Hanspel, he is Bright Machines CEO and co-founder with us here at Milken. We did it one day down.
One day down, two more to go.
Two more to go. I'm going to talk with Kathy Wood. We're going to hear a lot more conversations. They're all coming up. Have a good night, everybody.